Oppenheimers were deluged with letters, supportive letters from admirers, abusive letters from cranks, and anguished letters from close friends. Jane Wilson, the wife of the Cornell physicist Robert Wilson, wrote Kitty, "Robert and I have been shocked from the onset, and each new development fills us with nausea and disgust. Uglier little comedies have probably been played in the course of history, but I can't recall them." Robert tried to make light of the whole affair, telling his cousin Babette Oppenheimer Langsdorff, "Aren't you tired of reading about me? I am." But then the bitterness would seep out in wry comments like, "They paid more to tap my phone than they paid me to run the Los Alamos project." In a phone conversation with his brother, Robert said he had known all the time the way the affair would turn out. Though certainly disheartened, he was already trying to think of his ordeal as history. He told Frank in early July that he had spent $2,000 for extra copies of the hearing transcripts so that historians and scholars might study them. Some of his closest friends thought he had aged noticeably in the previous 6 months. "One day he would indeed look drawn and haggard," said Harold Chernus. "Another day he was as robust and as beautiful as ever." Robert's childhood friend Francis Ferguson was startled by his appearance. His short-cropped, speckled gray hair had turned silver white. He had just turned 50, but now, for the first time in his life, he looked older than his age. Robert confessed to Ferguson that he had been a damn fool and that he probably deserved what had happened to him. Not that he had been guilty of anything, but he had made real mistakes, like claiming to know things that he didn't know. Ferguson thought his friend knew by now that some of his most depressing mistakes were due to his vanity. "He was like a wounded animal," Ferguson recalled. "He retreated and returned to a simpler way of life." Reacting with the same stoicism he had displayed at the age of 14, Oppenheimer refused to protest the verdict. "I think of this as a major accident," he told a reporter. "Much like a train wreck or the collapse of a building, it has no relation or connection to my life. I just happened to be there." But 6 months after the trial, when the writer John Mason Brown compared his ordeal to a dry crucifixion, Oppenheimer answered with a thin smile, "You know, it wasn't so very dry. I can still feel the warm blood on my hands." Indeed, the more he tried to trivialize the ordeal as a major accident with no connection to my life, the more heavily it weighed on his spirit. Robert did not plunge into a deep depression or suffer any visible blows to his psyche, but some of his friends noticed a change in tenor. "Much of his previous spirit and liveliness had left him," Hans Bethe said. Robbie later said of the security hearing, "I think to a certain extent it actually almost killed him, spiritually, yes. It achieved what his opponents wanted to achieve. It destroyed him." Robert Serber always thought that in the aftermath of the hearings, Oppie was a sad man and his spirit was broken. But later that year, when David Lilienthal encountered the Oppenheimers at a party in New York, hosted by the socialite Marietta Tree, he noted in his diary that Kitty looked radiant and that Robert was looking actually happy, something I can't remember ever thinking about him. A close friend like Harold Chernus thought that both Robert and Kitty had come through the hearings amazingly well. Indeed, if Robert had changed at all, Chernus thought it was a change for the better. After his ordeal, Chernus said, Robert listened more and displayed a greater understanding of others. Oppenheimer was devastated and yet simultaneously capable of remarkable equanimity. He could pass off what had happened as an absurd accident, but such diffidence left him without the energy and anger that a different kind of man might have used to fight back. Perhaps the diffidence was a deep-rooted survival strategy, but if so, it came at considerable cost. For a time, Oppenheimer wasn't even sure whether the Institute's trustees would permit him to keep his job. He knew Strauss would like to see him ousted as director. In July, Strauss told the FBI that he believed 8 of the Institute's 13 trustees were ready to dismiss Oppenheimer, but he had decided to postpone a vote on the matter until the autumn so it would not appear that Strauss, as chairman, was acting out of personal vindictiveness. This proved to be a miscalculation, because the delay gave members of the faculty time to organize an open letter in support of Oppenheimer. Every member of the Institute's permanent faculty signed the letter, an impressive show of solidarity for a director who had bruised more than a few egos over the years. Strauss was forced to back off, and later that autumn the trustees voted to keep Oppie as director. Angry and frustrated, Strauss continued to clash with Oppenheimer at Institute board meetings. Strauss never relinquished his obsession with Oppenheimer, filling his files with memoranda that obsessively detailed Robert's alleged infractions. "He cannot tell the truth," he wrote in January 1955, about a minor dispute over a faculty sabbatical payment. Over the years, he filed away vindictive notes on Oppie's friends and defenders. He called Justice Frankfurter an unconscionable liar, and took delight in passing around rumors that Joe Alsop's sexual preferences made him vulnerable to Soviet blackmail.